It's Central Time. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson, in for Rob Ferret. You're with us on the Ideas Network. Coming up, we look at what Wisconsin will do with a new $10 million federal grant to improve early childhood education and care. First, is this what wine talk sounds like to you?
Don't be shy. Really get your nose right in there, really. A little citrus. Maybe some strawberry. Passion fruit. And, oh, there's just like the faintest sousson of like asparagus. And there's just a flutter of like a nutty Edam cheese.
Wow.
That is from the movie Sideways. Our next guest wants to make wine accessible to everyone and to take some of that elitism out of enjoying it. Elizabeth Schneider is a certified sommelier, certified specialist of wine, and the creator of the podcast Wine for Normal People. Her new book is titled Wine for Normal People, a guide for real people who like wine, but not the snobbery that goes with it. Elizabeth, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you so much for having me.
I have to ask, how many times have you tasted a soupçon of asparagus in your wine?
Never. I'm not even sure that I've even had that in food. And I eat a lot of asparagus. I don't even know what that is.
There you go. Well, is it a fair assessment to say that wine talk can sound like a foreign language?
Yeah. And here's the thing about it. Some of it is a foreign language. So some of it is, I remember when I first got into wine, I first had a career in technology. So I realized that sometimes when you get into things, there's a lexicon, you got to kind of get into things. But this was beyond that. This was things that were regular English, but when you put them all together, it didn't make any sense. Do you know what I'm talking about?
It's like I know every individual word, but together they mean nothing to me.
Yeah. And no one explains it, because wine, like I think other things in this world, it's like walking into a dark movie theater. You want to ask what's going on, but nobody's going to explain it to you, because if you start whispering, they'll be like, shh, be quiet. Don't you know what's going on? And I feel like that's what wine is about in large part. It really is not very friendly.
Well, it does seem that there may be some people, not all, in the wine world who would really like to maintain that sense of elitism, that it's kind of a club you're either in or you're not.
Oh, it's completely like that. And if you look at the certification bodies, it is very clearly a club. They do not want most people. And even in the industry, they don't want you in there, because at the highest levels, the pass rates for what is deemed a professional certification is 3 to 5 or 7%. That's not a professional certification. That's a club. So, in fact, they are looking to get people into a club.
One of the things I really like about how you talk about wine and expanding the ways that we can appreciate it is an analogy that you made. You said that when we start learning a foreign language, we would never expect to be fluent immediately. What does that mean to you in terms of getting to know wine?
Well, I think it's actually less frustrating in terms of wine, because what the thing about the foreign language is, like, you want to talk to people and you're sitting there and you just feel horrible. Now, wine has some of that, but we do experience it with our senses. So if we can get a little bit comfortable and confident and try to kind of, you know, slowly ease ourselves in, then we can really enjoy all of it. But these proclamations that you can take one class and become an expert or read one book and become an expert, it's just not true. You have to drink it. You've got to experience it. And you really have to be curious about it. That's the other thing. Like, I think intellectual curiosity is so important in wine. And there's so many ways to get into it too. So if you like food, you can get into it that way. If you like history, there's so much history. There's lots of history in the book, but there's lots of stuff that you can say, well, you know, that period of time really interests me. As long as it's after the Romans, pretty much you're in good shape. You know, they spread wine and viticulture all throughout the Western world, but art history and culture. I mean, so many different ways you can approach it. Geology, weather, everything. So there's so many different elements. If there's something that you're interested in, I bet that I could find a way for you to relate that to wine.
We're talking with Elizabeth Schneider right now. She's a certified sommelier, a certified specialist of wine, and her new book is titled Wine for Normal People, a guide for real people who like wine, but not the snobbery that goes with it. You can join in at 800-642-1100. 1, 2, 3, 4. And Elizabeth, we talked about it being a little bit like learning a foreign language. So let's go with one of the basics of learning a foreign language, basic vocabulary. How are wine varieties named? What does that mean if it's a Cabernet versus, say, a Gewürztraminer?
Well, this is a really important thing. So it's just all it is a species or a type of grape. So European grapevines are called Vitis vinifera. That's the kind of species. So the genus is Vitis and it's vinifera. We don't have that in the United States. That's not something that's native. Those are the European native grapevines. So Cabernet Sauvignon or Chardonnay is just the type of grape. Now, this is the really important thing and the thing that drove me crazy when I first got into wine. Some places, namely France, some of Italy, name their stuff by place. So the grape won't be apparent, but once you see what's there, it's all grapes that you know. So if I tell you that I'm giving you a Sancerre, you have to just realize that that's just Sauvignon Blanc. It's not, but in Europe, especially in some of the older places, they name stuff by place because the place was more important actually than the grape. So all of these grapes have been transported over to the US and Australia and to what we call the New World, which is everywhere but Europe. And as they moved, they decided to take the grape name because you can't really take the place with you, obviously.
Good point. Good point. Well, for as funny as it might sound to the uninitiated, all those different ways of describing what we might pick up on when looking at, smelling, and tasting wine does serve a purpose. And it can actually help us zero in on what we do and don't enjoy. So let's start with what you call the basics of tasting talk. And the first point is to see. So we're looking at the wine. What are we looking for?
Here's the real crazy thing about seeing or looking at wine. It's the most deceptive sense actually in wine tasting. So everybody looks at it. It's funny because you played that sideways clip and everybody's looking at their wine. What are you looking for? Well, the first thing you're looking for, is there anything dangerous or gross floating in there? I mean, who's going to drink? You need to get a filter if there's stuff floating in your wine. You don't want to drink that stuff. The wine should not have floaters in it. So if there's cork or like, you know, crystals, which are fine, there's like sometimes in Riesling, for instance, they don't do this process where they freeze it down or put the wine almost to freezing, and then it takes out the tartrates, and that will make sure that there's no little like crystals at the bottom. But sometimes you'll pour a glass of Riesling or Grüner Veltliner from Austria, and there'll be these little crystals. There's nothing wrong with it, but they're disgusting if you taste them. You don't want to taste tannin or sediment, all that sediment at the bottom, the little, you know, looks like Goldschlager, you know, from my college days. But it's wine Goldschlager at the bottom of the thing. You don't want to do that. So just get a filter, but you should be looking at your wine. Also, transport is hard on wine. It's an agricultural product. It's made from chemical processes. Stuff can go wrong. So don't drink it if it looks gross. That's the first thing. Color is secondary, and darker colors usually mean that it's from a warmer climate in whites and reds. And lighter colors mean that it's from a cooler climate. Hmm.
Next is swirling, and I think a lot of us might feel a little self-conscious doing this in public because we feel like we're doing something that we don't quite understand, but we know we're supposed to. So what do we learn from swirling the wine around in the glass?
Okay, again, totally practical thing. So let's pretend the wine is like this prisoner trapped inside of a bottle. It has no oxygen, barely any oxygen. It's just sitting there. It's kind of embalmed in there. Well, once you let the cork out of the bottle or take the screw cap off, which, by the way, great closure. Don't be afraid of screw cap. Then you're letting in air. And what that does is, again, it's allowing a little bit of a chemical reaction to happen with the wine. And then the wine becomes its best self. So after being trapped inside that bottle, it just needs a little bit of air. And what swirling does is just increases the amount of airflow through the wine. So it becomes more alive and fresh. You always want to hold the glass by the stem because, you know, I don't like stemless glasses. Your hands are hot. And so they're going to change the temperature of the wine. So those stems are really, really important. Plus, it makes swirling a lot easier. If you have a stemless glass, it's kind of awkward.
I also thought it was interesting that you said that for the wine to really have room to breathe literally and figuratively, that it's better to fill it at the most a half full in your glass. So even if we are thinking of having a fair amount of wine, maybe a few smaller glasses instead of one really big glass.
Yeah, you know what the worst is? You go to a restaurant and they give you those giant filled up glasses. There's no room to swirl. And that is when you are going to get it all over yourself. So I always just ask them if I could have a second glass, even if they, you know, just to pour it in, if they're not busy and I'm not being annoying, whatever, because I used to be a server, so I totally understand what that's like. But you shouldn't pour. That's when you're going to get into the mess of the bad swirling. So just you just fill it a little bit and get that air in. And there's always more. Don't worry.
And there is also something about kind of how, I don't want to say thick, but how the wine kind of clings or doesn't to the glass, right?
Yes. And they're called tears or legs. It's actually a very interesting effect that was discovered by this Italian called Marangoni. And he did a paper. And I think there was a French guy who actually discovered it, but this guy really articulated it in a paper. And basically what it says is there's a surface area difference, or a surface tension difference rather, between water, which is what wine mostly is, right? Wine is mostly water, and then the alcohol and the sugars. So when you swirl on the glass, what runs down first is the water. What's left on the sides are those alcohols or sugars. And it makes sense since alcohol is just fermented sugar. So then we've got, you know, that's sort of how you can tell if a wine's really high alcohol. So that's a good indicator of what's about to hit you. If you know, that alcohol feeling almost feels like a shot, burns going down your throat. So those high alcohol wines, which people always say, oh, I get a headache from wine. Check your alcohol levels, because if things are around the 14% mark, which a lot of California wines, especially are places from real sunny places, you're going to get that. And that will give you a headache, by the way, too.
We're talking with Elizabeth Schneider right now. She's a certified sommelier and certified specialist of wine. Her new book is titled Wine for Normal People, a guide for real people who like wine, but not the snobbery that goes with it. And we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. Are you intimidated by a wine list in a restaurant or by trying to pick out a bottle in a store? What part of how wine is talked about is the most confusing to you? And if you're looking for something you might like, let Elizabeth help. Give us a call at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll pick up the conversation after this short break. Stay with us here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Judith Sears Poisson. Right now, we're picking up our talk with Elizabeth Schneider. She's a certified sommelier, certified specialist of wine, and the creator of the podcast Wine for Normal People. Her new book is titled Wine for Normal People, a guide for real people who like wine, but not the snobbery that goes with it. And we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. Do you feel like you know how to navigate the world of wine? Do you get intimidated by how wines are described? What about price? Are you unsure of how much you might need to spend to get a bottle that you'll enjoy? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email us at ideas@wpr.org. Now, Elizabeth, we've looked, we've swirled, and now we're going to sniff. And I love how you describe the kind of sniffing to do. It has to do with dogs.
It does have to do with dogs. You know, dogs are awesome sniffers. Do you have a dog, Judah?
I don't, but as soon as you said that, I thought of it. They do the quick, rapid sniffing, not like a huge, I forget how you say, not like you're smelling your Thanksgiving turkey.
Yes, right, exactly. So they actually have stereophonic noses. Can you tell how nerdy I am? I go down these rabbit holes. It's just so bad. I can't stop myself. So they have four chambers in their noses, actually. So they can smell a lot more and distinguish so many more things. I would love to be a dog for a day just to be able to smell every wine in the world, actually. But anyway, beyond that, what happens is that when we sniff, if you do that big anteater sniff where you're just sucking in the wine, the problem is you fatigue your nose. You know, when you go to the perfume counter at Macy's or wherever and it just stinks, they're overwhelming you with
overwhelming
all that.
Overwhelming is a good way to put it. Yes.
Yeah. Well, what happens to your nose is that your nose is now fatigued because you have these little sensors, these receptors, and they've gotten too much information, and it's very hard for you to process that. So now all you smell is you know, that one really stinky note and you can't smell anything else. You got to wait for a while for your, for things to calm down. So you don't want to do that with wine. Instead, you just want to take small little sniffs after you've swirled the wine and it's got a little bit more going on. Now you can smell it. And that's when you just sort of think about what comes to mind. And the things that I try to say, your nose is now transmitting information to your brain and your brain is saying, what is that? What is that? Oh my gosh, what is that? So in the book, I always lay out, and I teach online classes also. And one of the things I always do is give a vocabulary sheet out because I feel like it's on the tip of your brain. You're sitting there going, wait, is that flowers? What does that smell? It smells like something I know. That experience is so frustrating. And then it doesn't help that people are like, well, it's like Rabenstein apples and whatever that guy said, whatever Miles said in Sideways, or they're like, it smells like whatever. I mean, and you're like, I don't even know what that is. I don't know what that is. Maybe to you, it smells like lemons, or to me, it smells like limes or citrus, whatever. So I just say, try your best to figure out what category it falls into, because sometimes things smell like fruit. A lot of times wine doesn't even smell like fruit, especially from Europe. So it's important sort of to characterize it and to do it with some confidence and with some guide, like have that vocabulary sheet around. It really helps a lot.
Let's go to the phones at 800-642-1234. And Douglas is up in Chicago. Hi, Douglas.
Hi, Elizabeth. How are you?
Hey, Douglas. Douglas is a longtime podcast listener.
Well, there you go.
Happy Hanukkah. I'm wondering what you've been pouring during these 8 nights. And also, if you have any advice for like defensive buying before the tariffs take over, if you think they're going to take over.
Thanks for those questions, Elizabeth.
So what have I been pouring? I've been pouring a little bit of everything, but champagne has definitely actually been on my table. I am Jewish, so latkes and champagne are really fantastic. I also had a delicious Grechetto from Umbria, which is the Italian wines tend to be really, they can be crisp, but also have this kind of like softness to them, which is really, really nice with fried foods and things like that. And I had a lasagna last night, so we had some Italian wine with that. In terms of the tariffs, now just to quickly explain what's going on there, unfortunately, there's a dispute over aircraft with Airbus. And as a result, the administration in the U.S. is thinking about putting 100% tariff on all European wines. That is going to be pretty crippling to the industry here because we think of the wine industry as being California and Washington and all the producers, but there's a whole bunch of people who also make their money selling wine from abroad and importing it. And so that's going to be quite difficult. So defensive buying, I mean, I would say we just have to keep watching to see whether or not there's already a 25% tariff on French wine, but we'll have to see if that goes, when that's going to go into effect. And before, I would say we should probably think about buying a few cases of your favorite wines because it's going to be a little bit of a bumpy ride before that stops.
We're talking with Elizabeth Schneider right now. She is the author of Wine for Normal People, a guide for real people who like wine, but not the snobbery that goes with it. And Elizabeth, I want to get back to our little progression there. So we've looked at it, we've swirled it, we've sniffed it. Finally, we're ready to actually taste it. What do we add to the profile when we actually take a sip of that wine?
Judith, I love that you just said that you said, like, what do we add to the profile? Because I think actually your nose is one of the most important, or is the most important thing. All you're doing when you're tasting, taste is a really funny thing because it's a little deceptive. It's also smell. You're getting closer to those smell receptors. So you have a whole other experience of it being right up close and personal. But then you also have texture. So you have, is it acidic? Underneath your tongue is watering. That usually means it's going to go pretty well with food. Is it tannic, which is that mouth drying, mouth puckering, like dry, you're in the desert and haven't had water for 5 years. And then there's, there's other things. Is it alcoholic? We talked about that burn. So as you put the wine in your mouth, it sometimes helps to hold it there for a second. That way you're giving your smell receptors a little bit more time to pick up information. And then when you swallow the wine, then you get a kind of impression of what it is. What is it? Is it making your tongue water? Is that something you like or don't like? Is that mouth drying sensation something you like or don't like? Would it be better with food? Lots of times wine is better with food. So you taste it out of turn. You have these wine tastings where no food is involved. And really some wines are made to go with food. I would say pretty much the entire portfolio of Italian wines should be consumed with food. So having it alone is not going to show it best.
So, Elizabeth, what do we do with all that information? We might learn that we like or don't like a particular bottle. How do we use that information then to know what we might want to try next?
It's so great to be able to actually articulate or think about the things that you liked about the wine and don't like about the wine. And this is where that vocabulary, as annoying as it is, comes into play. Because all you're doing is now you're going to take this set of things that you know you like, and sometimes it's more helpful to say the things you do not like, and then bring them to the mountain, which is that sometimes snotty person at the wine store or sometimes really nice person at the wine store. But if the more that you can speak their language and get on that page, they will be able to direct you to all sorts of things that you didn't even know existed. So I think the really important thing is to try to get some of that lexicon and vocabulary. And that's why in the book, a lot of books take that vocabulary and shove it in the back. I spend 3 chapters on vocabulary in various different forms, because if you don't get that down, it's going to be so difficult to communicate. The point of communicating is not so you can write your own tasting notes and wax poetic about wine and blah, blah, blah. It's just so you can get really great stuff from people who speak that language.
So, Elizabeth, I'm hoping that some people who are listening are feeling a little more confident, like, you know, maybe they can do some tasting and maybe go and, you know, try out some different wines. For people who might be just getting started with trying to develop, you know, that sense of smell and that sense of taste and how to describe it, paying a little more attention to what they're drinking, are there some good varieties to start with?
It depends on whether you like red or white, but the thing that I like to do is find things that are very crisp and very clear. So as you get into the wine world, things become more complex. And so I think things like Riesling, a nice German Riesling, whether you like sweet or dry, the flavors generally tend to be very clear. Something from the Mosel Valley, M-O-S-E-L, or something from an area called Pfalz, if you like dry wines, P-F-A-L-Z. Those have really clear flavors. If you like Sauvignon Blanc, New Zealand Sauvignon Blanc, very clear flavors, easy to describe, easy to pinpoint, easy to say, oh, that tastes like grapefruit. You know, so that's very good. Gewürztraminer is another one from the Alsace region of France, which is it's got very clear notes. So I think, and then if you like reds, I would even say something like a Beaujolais is great. Clear flavors.
Well, Elizabeth, thank you so much for joining us. It was a lot of fun.
Thank you so much. I appreciate it.
Elizabeth Schneider is a certified sommelier and the creator of the podcast Wine for Normal People. That is also the title of her new book. Governor Evers announced earlier this week that Wisconsin received $10 million in grant money from the federal government. The funds are intended to help states strengthen their early childhood systems, including in the areas of education, health care, access and affordability of child care. For more on the story, we're joined by Scott Girard. Scott is a reporter covering local K-12 education for the Cap Times. Scott, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, before we get to the grant and what Wisconsin's going to do with it, could you first set the table for us? What are some of the biggest challenges we've been facing as a state when it comes to early childhood education and care?
Sure thing. So one of the biggest hurdles for school districts, at least, is 4K programs are only funded at half. 4K students count as half a student for a school district. And so if they were to run a full-day 4K program, they actually lose some money on that compared to students from kindergarten through 12th grade and how much they receive for those students from state aid. So that can be a challenge, and there are very few districts throughout the state that actually have full-day 4K. So here in Madison, for example, they only have a half-day program, and that's similar around the state for districts that even have half-day. Some don't even have that. One of the other challenges that has come, especially in rural areas, is the lack of child care options. So a lot of areas just don't have the numbers to support child care centers for families to find before that 4K programming that begins for four-year-olds through school districts. So it's been a challenge out there. The state legislature has been considering a bill that would expand 4K funding so that it applied for students and counted them as a full student for funding, which would allow a lot of districts to expand. Some child care centers around the state did express concerns during a public hearing earlier this year about what it would mean for their business. Some legislators also made the point that there are some areas in the state that just don't even have child care centers to provide support otherwise. So really one of the biggest challenges is just reaching families and letting them know about the programming that does exist or finding programming for them to access.
And in October, Scott, we talked with you about Wisconsin having the worst racial achievement gap in the United States as well. That seems like a pretty large challenge, too.
Yes, absolutely. And there are many studies that indicate, many experts have indicated that early childhood education is one of the key ways to reduce that achievement gap. That 0 to 5 age time can be key in setting students up for success, both behaviorally and educationally. And so reaching students and families in that time and ensuring they're using best practices and things like that to get their children ready for school, for a school setting, is a very important thing going forward.
We're talking with Scott Girard right now. He's a reporter covering local K through 12 education for the Cap Times. And we're talking about a $10 million federal grant that is coming to Wisconsin to help with early childhood systems. So this $10 million grant is now coming to the state. How significant is that when we look at what some of these efforts cost?
Yeah, you know, I think that's a good amount of money. It'll be interesting to see how it gets spent. So it's a planning grant. So it's really aimed at bringing together different groups to discuss the issue further and work towards solutions. And so it's always a question of how that money is spent on those efforts and who it's bringing into that conversation. So the early indication is that a collaboration among Governor Tony Evers, his wife, officials from DPI, the Department of Public Instruction, as well as from the Department of Children and Families, will be working with a newly created Leadership Council on Early Years, which is basically a council focused on these early education issues, to kind of reach out and try to bring in different voices to the conversation about early education in the state. So, you know, $10 million could be significant in those efforts, but it really depends on how it's spent in those outreach efforts. But the officials who have commented so far have all really talked about trying to bring a diverse group of stakeholders involved in providing feedback on what policies can help close this gap. So in the news release announcing it, it mentioned sectors like business, healthcare, and higher education that can hopefully contribute to the conversation. So
it does sound like there are a lot of stakeholders that are going to be involved in kind of a guidance or an advisory capacity. But who is actually going to be responsible for spending the money and implementing the grant?
Yeah, so it will be, again, it will be a collaboration among the governor, Department of Public Instruction, the Department of Children and Families will be in charge of sort of determining how exactly that money is spent.
And what do we know, Scott, about why it's important to put more resources into early childhood education and development? What kind of payoff do we see as children grow and become adults?
Yeah, one of the biggest things that comes from early childhood intervention that I've heard from both reading some studies and some different experts that we've spoken with in my time here is the behavioral lessons and the understanding of what it means to be cared for and loved and supported, and having those sort of social emotional lessons can really prepare students to be ready to learn when they get to school. So it's not necessarily, you know, you're taking one-year-olds and teaching them math or getting them ready for calculus in kindergarten or anything like that. But it's really getting them prepared for a school setting so that when they arrive, they're ready to learn, interact with other students. But there are certainly a lot of benefits to early literacy as well. So reading and learning letters and things like that is also very valuable at those early ages.
Often grant funds come with some strings attached or some conditions that have to be met. Do we know anything about whether there are restrictions on how this money can be spent? Or, for instance, does the state need to come up with any kind of matching funds?
From what I am aware of, there are no matching funds the state is required to come up with. But the restrictions, really, from what I can tell, are just that it has to be spent on planning for developing programming for birth through five-year-olds. And so it really aims to build a whole systematic approach versus kind of leaving it to individual communities and the market to control. So it, as far as I can tell, there are no specific restrictions other than it being focused on planning or for early learning systems across the state.
So this is money to help with planning, which is great. And I'm guessing that there will also be price tags attached to what comes out of the planning, and especially if they're going to be multi-year efforts. Do we know if there is additional money that might be available for that?
Sure. So, yeah, according to the First 5 Years Fund organization, they have some information on this, on these grants. So the first time these grants were awarded was actually last December, and they were awarded to 46 states and territories. Wisconsin was not among those. And so those were all planning grants, and then those states were able to reapply for more funding to begin implementing their plans this year. So obviously the federal budget is always up for discussion, and it's no guarantee that these grants will be funded again a year from now. But if they are, I would imagine Wisconsin would be able to apply for some funding toward its implementation, as these other states have been.
So some states, it sounds like, are basically a year ahead. They've gotten the money for planning already. Do you know if Wisconsin is planning to look at any of those other states and maybe, you know, learn from things that they have figured out already, so we're not starting, you know, at ground zero?
Sure. I haven't heard anything specifically on whether or not they plan to kind of evaluate what other states are doing, but I think there's certainly a lot of opportunity, you know, in looking at the list of states that received money last year. There's a few that received right around $10 million, just like Wisconsin did. And so looking at how they spent that money and looking at the efforts they did and the results of those efforts is certainly something I would not be surprised to see.
State Superintendent Carolyn Stanford Taylor is quoted as saying, "This exciting opportunity for our state has the potential to transform the way we serve families and prepare our children for their K-12 education." Scott, in studying what's going on in K-12 education around the state, is there a sense of what we would need to do to really transform the system, to especially to close that racial achievement gap and improve our early childhood system?
Sorry, could you repeat the question?
Sure. Is there an indication of what we would need to do to really close that racial achievement gap?
You know, it's hard to say. It's something that the state has identified as an issue for a long time and has not had success. So it's hard to say that there's one fix. One thing I think you hear from a lot of people involved in the education world is that there isn't a single fix. There is no silver bullet to solve the problem. It's going to take a lot of efforts from a lot of different places to fix that gap. But I think early childhood education has certainly been a key factor and making sure that you're reaching as many children as you can with those efforts.
Well, Scott, thanks so much for joining us again.
Absolutely. Thank you for having me.
That's Scott Girard, local K-12 education reporter for the Cap Times. We talked to him today about a new federal grant that Wisconsin received. It's aimed to help better develop the state's early childhood system. Phrases like, boys will be boys, time to man up and take it like a man, are pretty common. But what do we really mean by them? And is there any harm in what they represent? Especially in the time of Me Too, more attention has been paid to what governs male behavior and how much men and boys should be held accountable. But even so, there are a lot of assumptions about maleness and masculinity that persist. And our next guest says that the idea that men and boys cannot control certain urges do them a disservice and has serious cultural repercussions. Matthew Gutman is professor of anthropology at Brown University. He's been studying men and masculinities for nearly 30 years, especially in China, Mexico, and the United States. He's the author of the new book, Are Men Animals? How Modern Masculinity Sells Men Short. Matt, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks very much for having me.
Well, when we use the word masculinity, what are we actually referring to?
I think it there's not just one definition. For some people, it's got to do with biology and genitals and Y chromosomes and things like that. For other people, They think of one person acts more masculine than another person, or somebody could say that at certain times they act more masculine than at another time. I think it varies. And most of us who study men and masculinities actually don't talk about masculinity in the singular, but in fact that there's a range. Hmm. Not that there is nothing in common. There are broad commonalities, but there's also tremendous diversity in what it means to be a man, and that's why it's important not to get stuck in some biological definition.
Well, and sex and gender are not the same. How do those ideas intersect with ideas of masculinity or femininity, for that matter?
Well, the question, I think, for a lot of people is, to what extent is this inborn? I was born a man, I was born a woman, or I was born with ambiguous genitalia, as it's called, and therefore I must act, or I want to act, or I do act one way or another, and I think one way or another. And that's where I think we get into a lot of trouble. And usually sex or sexuality is often associated with more physical stuff, with more biological, and gender more social. But the fact is, they have a lot of connections with each other. They're not, you know, the world is not a neat sort of biology over here and culture over there. There's a lot of back and forth. And in profound ways, we're biocultural creatures.
You've looked at the concept and practice of masculinities in a variety of cultures. I'm curious whether you found more differences or more similarities in how cultures define what it is to be a man.
A lot more differences. And it's by region within a particular place. It's rural, urban. It's age groups. When my kids were born and I was in the delivery room, my father said, "This is crazy. What are you doing there? You should be out in some bar having a cigar." I mean, it's just stereotypical kind of thing from a very bygone era. So I think that there's differences along those lines. There's differences by class. In Mexico City, for instance, where I've looked at issues of fatherhood, it's fascinating that the higher you get economically, the less you might have to do with your children day to day. You hire people. So I once had a guy who was a banker criticize me, or just sort of call me out for wearing a Snuggly with one of my kids when they were very little. And he said, "That's what I pay somebody for, to carry my kids.
I'm going to stop you for a second, Matt. We're getting a lot of rustling from your mic, so maybe if you can hold it away from your shirt, that might help.
Okay.
Great. So you said that there are a lot more differences than similarities, and I'm guessing that for an anthropologist like yourself, that gives a lot of weight to the idea that culture has a lot to do with how we expect ourselves and others to act.
I think it does, but, I mean, take some recent events. Take the Brett Kavanaugh Supreme Court hearings. One of the things that you could hear, and I've collected quotes from the New York Times, from CNN, from Forbes magazine, where people explain an assault by a teenage boy against a teenage girl by reference to testosterone, as though this actually would explain Kavanaugh's behavior at that particular time. In terms of what he was accused of, it had nothing to do with it. It had absolutely, nobody took his testosterone levels. Nobody has ever argued that he had higher levels. Most young men do not assault young women or young men. And they have testosterone running through their veins too. But it's an easy way for some people to explain the world around them. And it's a way of saying, well, you know, teenage boys, they have this sudden hormone surge and they can't control it. The fact is, a lot of boys do, most boys do. So that I think we get into trouble because we're saying biology is somehow ultimately responsible for bad behavior, and in this case, really egregious behavior of sexual assault.
We're talking with Matt Gutman right now. He's professor of anthropology at Brown University, and we are talking about his book, Are Men Animals? How Modern Masculinity Sells Men Short. We'll be back with Matt in just a moment.
The news that keeps you informed, the discussions you care about, music that helps you relax, and laughter that puts everything in perspective. Today, make your year-end gift to support the reasons you value, the vibrant and varied programming you enjoy every day on Wisconsin Public Radio. Go to WPR.org and click Donate, and thanks.
We are talking with author Matthew Gutman about his book, Are Men Animals? How Modern Masculinity Sells Men Short. And we're just talking about testosterone. And, you know, there are so many cases where, as you said, Matt, we just say, oh, well, you know, there was so much testosterone in that room, no one could get a word in edgewise. But you say that that's really doing men and boys a disservice. Tell us more about that.
Well, it's not only doing men and boys a disservice, it's doing women a disservice. The fact is that testosterone is key for ovulation in women, but we don't hear too much about that. There have also been correlations found between levels of testosterone and generosity, but we also don't hear much about that. When Billy or Johnny cleans up his room and makes his bed, nobody walks around saying, well, you know, after all, boys will be boys. That's not the point. There's something that we've come to believe about an innate quality to boys, particularly with respect to aggression and sexuality, that I think actually gets us into more trouble because it does let men off the hook. It says almost, you know, they can't help themselves, the poor guys. So we have to stop them. But it's really not their fault. It's their biology's fault.
I'm fascinated that there are very different attributes of testosterone than the ones that we usually hear about. Why do you think it is that, for instance, you know, the assumption of being aggressive gets attributed to testosterone, but as you said, generosity doesn't?
I think it's part of a bigger issue. I think that in many ways, DNA, chromosomes, hormones, evolution, heredity, All these things have come to stand in some fashion for who we are. So you take 23andMe or Ancestry.com and you see ads on TV and people will say, well, I used to think I was such and such, but now I know I'm such and such. And therefore, I know why I behave the way I do because my ancestors, you know, 200 years ago, we're from a particular part of the world, as though all people in that part of the world behave a certain way.
We are talking right now with Matthew Gutman about his book, Are Men Animals? And he is a professor of anthropology at Brown University. He's been studying men and masculinity for nearly 30 years, especially in China, Mexico, and the United States. And we're getting a range of opinions on the topic of masculinity on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Daniel writes, boys will be boys may be an excuse for kids getting in a fight on the playground, not for a grown man committing crimes. Masculinity is not the problem, but many people view it in the wrong way. Travis writes, boys will always be boys and masculinity will never be removed from society. With this in mind, we want to get your opinions on the topic of masculinity, both how it impacts men and women and if the context is being construed. You can join the conversation by calling 800-642-1234. If you're a man, what messages did you get growing up about how you should act or not act for that matter? Do you feel like those ideas were helpful or did you feel constrained by them? If you're raising a boy, do you find yourself falling into ideas of how males are built to behave? Do you think that you excuse or accept behavior because you think they are part of male biology? Give us a call at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can also post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll be back with Matt Gutman and hopefully hear from you right after the news. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson, in for Rob Ferret. Please stay with us here on Central Time.